ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 6th of March. I'm Rachel Mealy in Brisbane, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people. Iran has launched a fresh wave of strikes across the Gulf states in the last few hours, triggering emergency warnings in some of the region's biggest cities. It comes as Israel intensifies its strikes in Lebanon, prompting thousands of people to flee the south of the capital, Beirut. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran is in Jerusalem for us this morning. Matthew, what's the latest?
Well, Rachel, good morning. We have seen another wave of drone attacks across the Gulf region, mainly on the United Arab Emirates, with reports of explosions near Abu Dhabi's international airport. But there have also been sirens going off in Dubai, which is about an hour and a half's drive away as well. In the last short while, we have also seen an announcement coming through from the general staff of the Kuwaiti army, saying that Kuwait's air defences are dealing with missile attacks and drones coming in as well, and that is causing sirens to go off across that country too. So it had been something of a more calm day across the region overnight Australia time, but clearly that is now ratcheting up with Iran launching a fresh wave of strikes. Iran has launched, according to its state news agency, more than 500 ballistic missiles and naval missiles and around 2,000 drones since Saturday when this conflict began. It is saying that around 40% of those launches were aimed at Israel and about 60% at American targets in the broader region, including in the Gulf. But we know, of course, that civilian sites in the Gulf have been hit as well. It hasn't just been US military targets there. We also saw earlier today claims that Iran had hit a tanker in the Persian Gulf there too. So this is still a very fluid situation, still unfolding this morning Australia time, but showing again that this conflict is far from over.
And Matthew, Israel has continued bombing Lebanon. What's happened there?
So major strikes in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, but also in the southern parts of the country, with fresh evacuation orders issued throughout the day by Israel. They call them evacuation orders. Locals would call them forced displacement orders there. And we do know that tens of thousands of people have been displaced already. There's been bumper-to-bumper traffic in Beirut as people have been trying to leave those areas. And there is a real concern that that too is escalating as well. Israeli forces have moved in on the ground in Lebanon, particularly in the southern reaches there. That started yesterday, including some direct contact between Hezbollah forces and Israeli forces in some of those small villages. It does appear that this is also a new front in this conflict, and this could drag on for even longer than anything which happens in Iran, if the US, for example, calls time on fighting that's happening there. For his part, the French President Emmanuel Macron is trying to play something of a peacemaker. In this place, he is calling on both the Lebanese government to take a firmer stance against Hezbollah, to pull it into line. He's calling on Israel to show some restraint. But in the face of both of those calls, he is also confirming that France will provide armoured vehicles to the Lebanese armed forces to help them out during this period.
Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran. The military action in Iran has drawn attention away from domestic issues in the United States in recent days, but they're front and centre again today with Donald Trump's announcement he's replacing his embattled Homeland Security Secretary. Kristi Noem has been under pressure over her handling of immigration enforcement issues. Barbara Miller joined me from Washington. Barb, what's behind this move?
Well, Kristi Noem has been under pressure for some time. She was in charge of the immigration enforcement operation, and that criticism really ramped up after the killing in two separate incidents of two civilians in Minnesota. She was very quick to describe those as acts of domestic terrorism. Videos of the scenes of both those killings did not back up those assertions. And I guess those killings really brought to a head brewing criticism of these operations, which, of course, in a number of US cities had seen people literally ripped out of their cars, taken from their homes in this crackdown on what the government said said, were illegal immigrants. Of course, some of the people who were arrested and detained turned out to be American citizens. But it also seems, Rachel, as though a bit of a final straw was her appearance before a Senate hearing this week. On the one hand, she didn't apologise to the families of Renee Good and Alex Pretty, but she also told that hearing that Donald Trump had personally approved a controversial ad campaign in which she featured prominently, an ad campaign about immigration enforcement. And Donald Trump was reportedly pretty angry about that testimony. In fact, so angry he gave an interview later to Reuters and said that he hadn't approved that controversial ad campaign. So a bit of a come down. Kristi Noem was once considered a possible vice presidential candidate for Donald Trump. She's a former governor of South Dakota. But it's not all over. In his Truth Social post, Donald Trump says that Kristi Noem will become special envoy for the Shield of the Americas. Now, he says that's a new security initiative, which he says he will announce this weekend.
And Barbara, on Iran, the President Donald Trump has given the thumbs down to the idea that the son of Iran's supreme leader be appointed his successor. What's he had to say?
Yeah, this is the president responding to reports that Mojtaba Khamenei was about to be appointed successor to his father. Donald Trump, in a couple of interviews, has been scathing of that suggestion. He told Axios that Mojtaba was a lightweight, and he said he wanted to be directly involved in the appointment of a new leader. How exactly that would happen, he didn't say. And he said, you know, as I was with Delcy Rodriguez in Venezuela, who took over from Nicolas Maduro. So not the first time that Donald Trump seems to be equating what's going on in Iran with what happened in Venezuela, when, of course, are two very, very different scenarios. But clearly he wants to be calling the shots there. So a war in which he said he didn't necessarily want regime change, but seems to want to be in charge of who now leads the regime or the country.
Barbara Miller there in Washington. Well, the ongoing attacks on Iran and the ever-expanding retaliatory attacks have had a major impact on the world's seaborne crude oil supply, sending energy prices soaring. For motorists in Australia, this means the price of fuel will keep climbing at the pump. Madeleine King is the Resources Minister. She joined me earlier. Minister, Australia's oil and gas supplies are going to be hit hard by this war. Exactly how much do we have in reserve?
Well, disruptions like this, as we're seeing in the Middle East, are obviously disturbing to everyone, and we can't always avoid the ripple effects of such quite large conflicts, as we've seen through the travel disruption. But in relation to fuel, Australia is well stocked with fuel, like petrol for everybody's cars and diesel for the trucks that moves food and goods around. So we're confident that will remain the case. There has been some concern amongst the community that there may be some price gouging going on, and I'm concerned about that as well. Very importantly, the Treasurer has written to the ACCC to make sure they monitor fuel prices and take action as needed. At the moment, prices are holding steady. But as for gas, we are well supplied with gas as well, and a lot has changed since 2022 when we came into government and we saw a massive spike in gas prices. Since then, this government has taken action to disconnect the domestic price system and supply system from the export pricing system, especially on the East Coast. So that bodes well. And at the moment, gas prices are holding very steady, and they're under $10 a gigajoule.
On gas, energy analysts say that Australia is still vulnerable to global gas supply markets. How can you make sure that Australians won't fall victim to the current volatility?
Well, we are a global player in international LNG supplies. That is absolutely a fact, and that's been of great benefit to this country. But as I said before, we are not immune, and there are ripple effects, but we have taken action. So when we came into government, we reformed the Australian Domestic Gas Security Mechanism, which means should there be an urgent shortage of gas, I can take action and make sure that we hold that gas in this country for our own use. But that's not been demonstrated at the moment, and there's no indication that there will be a shortage. But should that happen, we have got the tools to make sure that gas will be available to Australian consumers.
There are reports this morning that Australian personnel were on board a US submarine when it torpedoed and sank an Iranian warship off the coast of Sri Lanka yesterday. Can you confirm that?
Well, we're not going to talk about the crews and operational matters on the submarines. There are long-standing arrangements relating to third country deployments. So it really isn't appropriate to go into those details.
Are Australians currently training with the US Navy as part of the AUKUS submarine training rotation?
Yes, they absolutely are. And I'm very pleased to say that I've met some of these Australian sailors when they have returned to HMAS Stirling, which is in my hometown of Rockingham.
Shouldn't we know whether our sailors are in harm's way?
Of course, the country, it's an operational matter. So we are not going to reveal either the names or who's who on a submarine.
Like that, I don't want names. I just want to know whether sailors are in a submarine.
It's just simply not appropriate to go into these details. But I've just explained that we do have personnel training through the AUKUS system, as one would expect. And we've been very open about that. But for operational security reasons, the Australian Defence Force does not and should not disclose specific details regarding third country deployments. And no one would expect us to.
Minister, on evacuations from the Middle East, is the government happy with the rate at which Australians are being able to return from the region?
We'd be happier if everyone was free to fly as they normally do. And we've got very accustomed to going through global hubs like Doha and Dubai. And I know I certainly do it semi-regularly. But in good news, there are more repatriation flights occurring. I know last night over 280 Australian passport holders landed in Sydney, and there are now four scheduled Emirates flights to Australia from Dubai in the next 24 hours. Two planned Etihad flights from Abu Dhabi as well. And I have heard, and I hope this comes to fruition, that Qatar Airways has started to organise a limited number of relief flights.
Has the consular response been good enough?
Absolutely. It's been exceptional. These are very difficult times. It's a conflict in the Middle East. It's a long way from home, and there are Australians caught out a long way from home. And the Department of Foreign Affairs are working very hard to make sure every Australian finds their way to a safe place and hopefully home. They might choose to go onward elsewhere, but in the meantime, we're keeping our people as safe as we can.
That's Federal Resources Minister Madeleine King. The federal government has officially banned Islamist group Hizbut Tahrir under its new hate speech laws. The government has listed the organisation as a prohibited hate group, making it the first organisation to be captured under the new legislation. It comes as Labor MP Ed Husic is saying Muslims should not have to, quote, beg for protection from the government, as he urges the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion to also examine Islamophobia. The Labor backbencher, who's also a Muslim Australian, has accused his party of failing to deliver on key commitments to Australians of faith. Political reporter Sarah Temevska has more.
In a highly disciplined Labor caucus, former Minister Ed Husic is one of few outspoken MPs.
The Royal Commission is about both anti-Semitism and social cohesion. And if there is not going to be an examination of Islamophobia, that is really concerning. Muslim Australians should not feel like they have to beg for protection.
Ed Husic was among the early advocates within Labor for a royal commission into the Bondi terror attack, which targeted Jewish Australians. He says the inquiry should examine Islamophobia as well.
Muslim Australians have relied on Labor governments because the other side of politics doesn't take this issue seriously. There is a lot that's been invested in our government for the voice to be heard and to be responded to and the protections extended.
Should there be a separate royal commission into Islamophobia?
No, I'm not arguing that by any stretch.
Since the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7, 2023, and Israel's subsequent assault on Gaza, the Executive Council of Australian Jewry has reported a 700% surge in anti-Semitic incidents, while the Islamophobia Register of Australia has documented a 620% increase in Islamophobic incidents. Bilal Rauf from the National Imams Council says many Muslims are disappointed by the Royal Commission's scope.
We have seen many incidents of people being verbally, physically abused across cities. So it's not as though it's an abstract or theoretical issue. It is happening right now and it is widespread.
Simone Abel from the Executive Council of Australian Jewry is happy with the Royal Commission's terms of reference.
What happened was a horrific terrorist attack, an anti-Semitic terrorist attack that targeted Australian Jews while they were celebrating Hanukkah. And that is why the Royal Commission needs to focus on anti-Semitism.
In January, the Prime Minister shelved plans to pursue racial vilification law reforms in the wake of the Bondi attacks due to a lack of Senate support. Instead, the Parliament passed watered-down legislation that made a new offence for hate groups. Both Simone Abel and Ed Husic say those reforms should be pursued.
We have now a Royal Commission that won't look at Islamophobia. We have not done anything as a government to progress the report on racism done by the Human Rights Commission. And we have not fulfilled a commitment that we have given to provide anti-vilification protection.
The ABC has contacted the Prime Minister's office for comment.
Sarah Tomefska reporting there. The head of Australia's biggest independent group of remote stores says Indigenous communities are struggling to afford enough food and it's worse than he's seen in 30 years. That's despite half of the nation's remote communities benefiting from the federal government's grocery subsidy scheme. Jane Barden reports from Warrawee on South Goulburn Island.
When families don't come into the only grocery store in the Northern Territory Indigenous community of Warrawee, the shop's manager Nathan Wood worries things are going wrong at home. Normally people in this community of 500 on remote South Goulburn Island off Arnhem Land shop for food every day.
You know, there's a lot of young children out here that don't get to eat every day because of the affordability costs.
Last year, the National Competition Watchdog found Australian grocery prices rose 24% over the last 5 years. In remote areas, prices are double those in cities. A small tin of corned beef costs $10 in Warrawee store. A tinned meat pie costs $17. Warrawee community leader Jenny Manmarulu.
Because of the freight, it cost a fortune to bring the groceries here.
Johnny Namua is a senior Warrawee traditional owner.
The prices are too high and we can't afford to pay all that.
The not-for-profit Arnhem Land Progress Association runs Warrawee's shop and 25 other remote stores in the Northern Territory in Queensland. Its veteran chief executive Alistair King says all their communities are suffering.
30 years I've seen good, I've seen bad, but I've not seen it as difficult as it is now. People are doing it really tough in communities.
Last July, the federal government brought in its most generous ever remote food subsidy scheme.
It's really helpful for people. And since that subsidy has come in, we have seen people buying other things other than just the basic groceries. Prior to the subsidy, 1 kilo flour out here was about $3.45. It's now $1.20.
Two-thirds of the Warrawee community depend on federal government welfare payments and pensions. Alistair King thinks the government should consider raising their Centrelink payments.
Because if you think about it, the social welfare does not go up like wages, CPI, right? Grocery costs, they go up every year. And the last few years has been terrible with the cost of living crisis, really impacting remote customers.
Warrawee community leader Jenny Manmarulu agrees.
The government have to start looking at people on Centrelink to increase their wages because it's not fair, you know.
Another local leader, Bunuk Galaminda, says remote communities need more help to ensure their kids have a healthy future.
We want to feed our children to go to school healthy, strong, every day.
Warrawee community leader Denny Munmurulu, Jane Barden, our reporter. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Part of the reason Donald Trump says he's gone to war with Iran is to destroy the nuclear threat it poses. Today, Kelsey Davenport from the Arms Control Association on why it could all lead to more nuclear weapons around the world. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.